I'm Len Sassaman. I'm going to be talking about some practical anonymity solutions. First off, let me define anonymity. Anonymity is the state of being anonymous within a set of users. We define anonymity as indistinguishability between other people or entities that are behaving the same way as you are. This group in its entirety is referred to as the anonymity set. So when we measure the strength of anonymity, it's measured according to, in part, the anonymity set size. If there's 10 participants in an anonymity system, then you have a maximum anonymity set size of 10. You can use that as a way of measuring the strength of your system. We also have to assume a given threat model. Who are your adversaries is your first question. What are you hiding? Who are you hiding from? What can the people you're hiding or entities you're hiding from do in order to try to break your anonymity? I'll go into these questions in more detail as I get into the talk, but these are things that we need to keep in mind, because for certain people, anonymity may mean something entirely different than others based on what information they're hiding and how others might try to get that information. So network anonymity services do a number of things. Primarily, they shield the identity of the user. You want to hide names, affiliations, other such identifying information. There's also the possibility of leaking side channel information that can identify a user or help narrow down that user's anonymity set, which network anonymity services also help conceal. They separate a user's actions from his identity. They don't hide the fact that certain actions are occurring. If you are fetching a web page over an anonymity system, you can't hide the fact that that web page is being retrieved. That is the realm of steganography, not anonymity. But what we do with the anonymity systems do is separate who is making that request with the request that's being made. Anonymity systems are also not the same as content privacy. While often it may be necessary for you to have both a content privacy system and an anonymity system in place in order to achieve anonymity, they are not inherently providing content privacy. So, who wants anonymity? If you ask users, do you want privacy, usually they'll say, absolutely, I value my privacy. But will they pay for it? The biggest problem with privacy-enhancing technologies being adopted is that there is a cost associated. Setting aside for a moment that most people are willing to give up the privacy for something as trivial as movie tickets or an opportunity to win an SUV and a sweepstakes, asking them to actually pay for privacy is a difficult prospect. With many security solutions, it's not a problem that your average user won't pay for privacy, because the people who really need it are willing to pay for it, and then they're protected and everyone's happy. With anonymity, it's especially important that users who may not otherwise feel the incentive to pay a lot for anonymity still be encouraged to participate, because there's a direct correlation between the number of users in the anonymity system and the strength provided. By getting more users, you increase your anonymity set size, and then you get greater anonymity strength out of the system. So, ideally, a strong anonymity system has to have a large user base of people who are someone that you are going to want to hide in. However, there's a large number of economic disincentives to using anonymity systems, last of which is monetary cost. People are willing to shell out a few bucks for something if that's all they have to do. But when it involves learning how to use a new program, adding extra steps to things that they normally do, making the prospect of using the network more difficult, leading them to have problems where they can't communicate with people they want to communicate with because they don't have a similar anonymity system or similar tools in place. The single fax machine problem: if you have a fax machine, no one else does, you can't really send information anywhere. And the problem of you're adding more complexity to your system, you're adding more places for things to break, all add up to reasons not to use anonymity. So all of these need to be addressed and solved in the anonymity solutions that we're going to talk about, or they don't get used. It doesn't matter how strong they are on paper, how good the math is, if it's too complicated in its implementation for users to use it, it's not going to provide you with any real anonymity. So, usability is very important. Any privacy-enhancing technology should be built such that there is only one way to use it, and that is the correct way. You should not be able to misuse it. You shouldn't be able to install it and then not do the right magic thing to make your privacy safe. This is a problem we have with email encryption, with any privacy-enhancing technology, but it is particularly important that we get this right with anonymity because of the fact, again, that if you don't have large numbers of users, you don't have anything. Cryptography has been getting better, much better, over the years, but in the early days, the people that needed strong cryptography were generally the military, and the fact that you had to take a number of extra steps before you could communicate, and this was a real pain in the ass, wasn't an issue. It was necessary. There's life or death on the line. There's secrets that need to be protected. We can't put those kinds of difficult requirements on something that we want your average internet user to use, because they're not going to go through a half an hour of key setup or learn some complicated techniques for doing what they really want to do anyway, which is send some email or browse the web. So, at the end of my usability rant, there is anything we build for privacy-enhancing technologies really needs to be very, very minimal, if at all, increase in effort and complexity on top of the base service that they're going for. Nobody wants a privacy solution for the sake of privacy. They want it so they can do something and still preserve their privacy. So, I'm going to do a lot of classification here, because different people need different things when they talk about anonymity, and they mean different things when they talk about anonymity. So, there is the concept of covert anonymity. You're anonymous, but people don't realize that you're using an anonymity system. It's pretty hard to do this with strong anonymity systems, but for some people, using a disposable Hotmail account counts as anonymity. It fits in their threat model. They don't have a very powerful adversary, and they can get away with this. Benefits to covert anonymity are basically that there's no stigma attached to the fact that you are communicating in a forum or accessing information through an anonymity network. Of course, any such stigma decreases as more people participate in strong anonymity systems. Then there's the obvious anonymity systems. Somebody using the system is apparent to a third-party observer as being a user of an anonymity system. There's the problem of credibility. If you've ever been in the mailing list discussion where an anonymous poster has contributed, there's no reputation attached to that person. There's no name, no background, and there's often the question, does this person know what they're talking about or not? And some of the services I'm going to talk about are a mixture between covert and overt anonymity. It may not be instantly obvious that this is an anonymity system, but if you look at it closely, you realize it is. Or you may have to be in a special position on the network or have certain surveillance capabilities that the average person doesn't have in order to determine this. I'm going to take questions at the end, but I'll answer that right now. You're asking if you use a made-up name versus your real name on Usenet. Are you anonymous when you use your made-up name and not when you use your real name? Well, you're definitely not when you use your real name. That the kind of anonymity that you might be referring to when you use a fake name on Usenet is not what we're going to be talking about here, because as I will explain, somebody observing the network can, or by analyzing your Usenet posts, quite possibly tie back that message to you, no matter what name you're using. But let's hold the questions till the end, please. That question actually leads into this slide, which is achieving anonymity is really dependent upon your own threat model. You might think, for your concerns, that you're anonymous when your name isn't attached to it, because somebody can't find your Usenet post when they're searching Google for your name. That might be enough for you. For others, it may be that you need to hide the fact that you're communicating from your ISP, your job, your small government that's monitoring the network, any possible different array of adversaries who have different capabilities. There are different portions in the total solution of anonymity, too. And depending on threat models, some of these are of greater importance under certain situations than others. We have different kinds of attackers, active versus passive. With anonymity, largely we're concerned about passive attackers. An attacker that is able to sit and monitor traffic, either on the entire system, part of the system, endpoints, but doesn't do anything to influence the network, merely observes. Can you maintain anonymity when they're simply observing your communication? An active attacker is someone who can manipulate the network in some way, or perhaps manipulate you in some way into breaking your anonymity. There's global versus local, and of course these different components can apply in different configurations to a single attacker. So you could have a global active attacker, a global passive attacker, etc. But a global attacker is one who can observe all of the network, or effectively all of the network, enough of the network that doesn't matter that it can't see the rest of the network. A global attacker is one we presume to be able to not only monitor the entire network, but also analyze what it's monitoring in real time. It does you no good if you're able to sniff the entire internet, but you can't process that data. And we need to worry about the sophistication of the attacks here. Is your adversary capable of processing large amounts of data? Is your adversary capable of analyzing and narrowing down anonymity set size based on distinguishing factors that may not be initially obvious? Anytime you have behavior on the internet where you're using a protocol that isn't explicitly designed with anonymity in mind, you have to worry about leakage of information. Browsing the web through some of these systems we're going to talk about will still possibly identify you if your browser is a less than common browser and it betrays information about you or about the size of your monitor or perhaps settings you've made. All those headers that are sent in the HTTP request are unique to a certain subset of users. So back to our example of anonymity set size. Let's say we have 1,000 people using the system, but only 100 of them are using Mozilla, and only 10 of them have cookies turned on in the way you do. Your anonymity set size is not 1,000, it's at most now 10. This, of course, is only pertinent to an attacker who is able to, or aware of these issues and monitoring this, but it is a concern. So there's a couple of solutions that, for web situations, we use. Middleman and Proxy, I'll talk about them more in a moment, but they are basically local content filters that filter out potentially dangerous information as it's being transmitted. You can configure these, whitelist, blacklist. There's always a trade-off between usability. You may decide, okay, I'm going to block every header possible except for these five ones I know I want. That may pose a problem later on if a website doesn't work because it expects a certain header. Getting back to the usability problem and the problem of how much effort are you willing to put into configuring this. In email, the example, of course, is if you're trying to post anonymously to Usenet, but your mail client automatically adds a SIG file that adds your real name. Just because you're calling yourself John Doe doesn't help if Bob Smith is in the SIG file. So these are not directly related to many of the anonymity, directly part of many of the anonymity solutions that we see available, but they are still extremely important as far as preserving your total anonymity. Then there's the rather difficult problem of transit anonymity. Assume you have someone who's able to monitor the network. You want to make sure that you can transmit your packet from your source to your destination without there being a linkage between you and the correspondent, be it a website, another email user, and so forth. The major applications for this in email, Mixmaster, and Mixminion. For the web, there's the Java Anonymous Proxy and the Onion Router, both known by their acronyms. All of these employ some variation of the mix method. There's different variants on mixes. I'll talk about them again in more detail, but we have pools, we have stop-and-go mixes. Those are two different methods as to how information is mixed up. And then there's cascades and free routes, which determine the path that messages take. The last component is reputation systems. We have the problem of not being able to link an anonymous poster with other comments made by that anonymous poster. And sometimes it's desirable to have a reputation, even if it's not linked to your real name, that allows you to communicate in a forum or have a web browsing session that allows you to continue to update it as though you're a regular user and you've been there before. You may want to pass a local session cookie back and forth. We refer to this as authenticated anonymity. In the Tor system, for instance, there are ways of achieving mutually known relationships between users of the system such that third-party observers aren't able to deduce who's who. They remain anonymous to third-party observers, even participants in the network. So we have a lot of public anonymity systems. Now, I say that, and that's kind of misleading, because private anonymity systems are not really very useful. If you're running an anonymity system for your corporation or your agency, it may not matter to your adversary who you are, but if you're at Acme Corporation and you're doing some competitive analysis and you have a private anonymity system, then you're an anonymous Acme employee, and that doesn't really actually achieve anything for you. You've built a system that's pretty much useless. So anonymity systems that are going to be useful for most cases have to be public. There have been a number of attempts at doing commercial anonymity systems. They try to provide anonymity for profit. They have an economic incentive themselves to protect their customers' identities because that's what they're selling. If they don't protect their customers' identities, their reputation will be impacted and they won't be able to sell their product anymore. They usually can't offer strong anonymity. But the problem with having anonymous customers is you don't know who to collect money from. Anonymizer.com is an example of a weak anonymity commercial organization. They are a trusted proxy, and they say that they do certain things, and you pay them money, and they promise that they won't give up your name. Zero Knowledge Systems tried to do a stronger version of this, but in the end ended up facing economic impossibilities in scaling their system with the number of users they had. We see a lot of anonymity systems offered by universities and other non-governmental organizations. The primary motivation in universities is usually research and observation and testing out theoretical concepts, learning from that. There's also the general idea of offering a good service to the internet community. Sometimes the entity involved may have a specific need. They may need an anonymity system themselves. And of course, in order to be anonymous and in order to have this matter, they need to have other users and be able to blend in. So the way to get this is to run an anonymity system, allow public users to use it, and then you have people to hide amongst. Since they don't collect money, they don't have to worry about who who to go after for money, and the anonymous payment systems that don't exist aren't a problem. MIT runs a pseudonym server under this method, and Voice of America has in the past targeted foreign countries that do internet censorship with ways of doing censorship circumvention using partially using anonymity techniques. Number of individuals, myself included, run anonymity services. Many of the individuals doing this have the same sort of motivation as the NGOs. They want anonymity, they want to see anonymity systems available on the internet, and they have, if they're lucky, the potential to operate a node or provide the service, and that indirectly helps us. Or there is an ideological incentive there. We want to see personal use of strong anonymity technology. We want to demonstrate that we have the technological capability of doing a certain anonymity technique. We want to prove our theories. Mixmaster remailers are an example of this. The Onion router nodes are an example of this. And then there's government and military involvement. Anything from wanting to have anonymous tip hotlines that allow people to report potential terror threats to needing anonymity themselves for investigating online crime or spying on other countries. Governments have an incentive to, on one hand, break anonymity. They are often a potential adversary, but on the other hand, a strong incentive to have anonymity available for themselves. And again, if you're an anonymous CIA agent, you're not really anonymous. It doesn't matter that your name isn't known if you're trying to hide the fact that you work for whatever government agency. These have to be public. You have to be able to blend in. As I alluded to, commercial anonymity systems tend to be weaker. They have the problem of money collection, and they need to be able to fund themselves. They tend to be more popular because they have better advertising models, but they're geared toward addressing passive concerns. Can I protect my financial data when I'm doing transactions on the internet? Can I hide my personal information from being displayed on a web page somewhere? Can I avoid having that picture that I put up on my website as a joke of myself in my underwear show up on someone else's web page forever? The anonymous communication aspect is a secondary concern here. However, it's still a part of most commercial anonymity solutions. It's hard to sell anonymity. It's hard to operate a strong anonymity service. As we'll talk about with systems like the Onion router and the previous zero knowledge system, when we have mixes that we don't want to be individually trusted, we have to have multiple mixes. We have to have traffic go through multiple different nodes who all don't trust each other. And if you're a central service trying to run this, you're paying for your bandwidth double, triple, four times. However many nodes your users choose, it becomes really expensive when they start downloading those porn DVDs, and your potential to make a profit is diminished. There's an uncertain demand for anonymity. Largely, this is like selling insurance. You have to convince people that there's a threat that they don't necessarily see. By the time they see it, they're probably not going to be a customer anymore because bad things have happened to them. But it's difficult to sell. There may be potential legal restrictions in certain countries, and there's abuse complications. Any anonymity system is going to invite the potential for abuse, and you have to be set up to deal with that. It's also hard to buy anonymity solutions that are strong. Because we don't have any method of anonymous digital cash, you need to give them your credit card, and then you have to trust that they're not going to link it to you. There's then the question that, well, are they really hiding the link between my username and my credit card? Do I believe them? The third-party auditability doesn't exist. And then, of course, the ease-of-use problem comes back again. Well, what is weak anonymity? I say that, and you might get the impression that it's bad. It may not be bad. It may be perfectly acceptable for what you need to do. You may want to avoid getting spammed when you post to Usenet under an address. So you want to be able to not advertise your real address. You may want to be able to communicate in an online forum. You know, who here ever posted a Slashdot? Who here has been flamed on Slashdot by somebody who's 13 years old and doesn't know a router from Switch? About the same many, the same number of hands. There's reasons to not want your real name in a forum, but you may want to just stop at, oh, it's a fake name, or, oh, I'm hiding from my ISP or my employer. Again, degrees of threat model here are the operative function, and you trust that your anonymity is being protected by either privacy laws or the reputation of a vendor or a private operator. That's the key point here. There's trust in a human, either a human institution, like a legal structure, or somebody's personal word. Strong anonymity tries to achieve all of that and more. We want protection from ISP snooping. That could be either the ISP or a third-party entity which has broken into the ISP and now has all the capabilities of the ISP. Protection from government monitoring. You don't want your mid-sized South American government to be able to watch everything you're doing and then, when they decide what is bad next week, go back and round up people that have been talking about it. You might want to be able to communicate to people who are in a foreign country without letting anyone on the path in between determine that they are communicating with you. This is not always... The people you're hiding from may not always be the ones you're worried about. You have to trust, if you're going to trust your ISP, you have to trust not only their motives, but their security. So, we want systems where if somebody breaks into the underlying infrastructure, you're still safe. The thing to remember here is we want to trust the system, be it mathematics, cryptography, information theory. We further divide anonymity systems into two categories. There's high latency solutions. These deliver messages in minutes to hours. There's low latency systems, which are not that much slower than using the normal network. There's a direct trade-off between latency, user numbers, and strength. Overall, a low latency system is worse than a high latency system. However, the problem with high latency systems is, well, for some things, like email, you can wait a half an hour for your message to be delivered. You're not going to want to wait a half an hour for your web page to load. That's just not possible. So, the deployed high latency solutions are primarily aimed at email or Usenet delivery. I'm going to digress here about remailers for a moment. Mixnets, which is the fundamental primitive used for both the remailers and the low latency systems we have, were first proposed by David Chaum in 1981. He described in the Communications of the ACM a method of anonymous communication where he put to use the newly developed public key cryptography and created a system where you can have strong anonymity with no one universally trusted authority. He also proposed a clever method of doing return addresses, which I'll get into in a bit. Chaum didn't implement this. This didn't actually even see the beginnings of implementation until about a decade later. In the early 90s, there was a very popular but weak anonymity mail server called anon.pennet.fi. It was a pseudonym server. It was created by Carl Kleinfest, but was maintained by a fellow in Finland. It was very easy to use, had over 500,000 users, and fell victim to what we refer to as a legal attack. Somebody subpoenaed somebody's identity, and he was forced to give it up. For all intents and purposes, when we're designing the systems, legal attacks and hacking attacks are the same. If the data is there to be obtained, it can be obtained through a misuse of a legal system or by simply breaking in and getting it. In this case, people were posting things about this UFO cult, and they didn't like that, and they sued them, and the rest was history. Yolf, the operator, shut down the system in order to not have anyone else's identities be leaked again. Simultaneously, the group of crypto revolutionaries who called themselves the cyberpunks were working on a better system. They wanted something that would not be victim to legal attacks. They borrowed ideas from Chom, but they missed a large number of Chom's points. They built their system based on PGP. It allowed nested encryption and mutually untrusted nodes. Traffic analysis on this was still possible. Message sizes that went through the network were traceable. There were possible tagging attacks where you could manipulate the encrypted data and determine when a message had passed through nodes based on the manipulation you had done. But they still exist in operation, even though they have all these flaws. The first real implementation that can be called a Chomian remailer, even though it has improvements and differences, was Mixmaster, begun in 93 by Lance Cottrell. It addressed mainly the major shortcomings in the Type 1 cyberpunk system, primarily the fact that message sizes varied. If you had a message you wanted to send, you would pick your list of remailers. Say you want to pick four remailers, A, B, C, and D. You'd encrypt your message to D, encrypt it to C, encrypt it to B, encrypt it to A. Using the original cyberpunk system, your D-encrypted message, as in the node D, is going to be dependent upon the size of the letter that you have in there, and then the encryption is going to grow as you layer on the crypto that you've added when you've encrypted it to the successive nodes. Mixmaster fixes each packet size at a certain length. Messages that are larger than that are split, messages that are shorter than that are padded, so all messages going through the system are of equal length. And due to the way they do their crypto, the messages aren't as susceptible to tagging attacks as using PGP as your wrapper. PGP is a fine crypto system, but not designed with prevention against anonymity attacks in mind. So it's unsuited for this purpose. Currently, Mixmaster is still the most widely used remailer software. It's being replaced by a new generation remailer called Mixminion, which I'll get into also in a moment. We refer to Mixmaster, the protocol, as Type 2 remailers because there's different software that implements the same protocol. I'll mention zero knowledge here. ZKS implemented, on top of their low-latency network anonymity system, a means of doing anonymous email. But this was, for all purposes, a low-latency system. It had all the problems of a low-latency system. Basically, they ran a POP server and an SMTP server over top of their network-level anonymity system. You can still do this today with the Onion Router, but you have to realize that this is not a high-latency strong email solution. This is a low latency solution and has the weaknesses inherent in it. I've just covered this actually. We have the multi-layered encryption chains. Chom proposed indistinguishable message packets, which we achieved in the Type 2 system. You want to randomly reorder your messages. As each message goes through the network and hits each node, you don't want a first-in, first-out system here, because then somebody watching the network can just watch the packets go through and they win. It's kind of like a shell game. You want, however, to be able to have messages enter into a black hole, the mix, and have them come out in an entirely different order. We achieve this through different methods. There's a variety of methods known as pool mixes, where messages come in and it's though they're falling into a hat. When enough messages are in there, messages start being randomly pulled out and you can't link them. The problem with this is there's no guarantee on latency, no lower bound on latency. There is a lower bound on anonymity in most of these pool systems, but you again have a trade-off here. There's another method which is referred to as stop and go mixes, where a message comes in that's given a random timestamp, and after that random timestamp, counter is expired, the message is sent. You have a guarantee of latency. You can set an upper bound on latency in this. However, you don't have a guarantee on anonymity. If for some reason the input traffic decreases, your anonymity is going to decrease, and you may be at risk of having zero anonymity. I've covered Mixmaster already. It runs on top of the SMTP network, which is key to note because we have multiple layers of failure there. There's potential problems with the Mixmaster servers, and there's potential problems with your underlying MTA. Here's a graphic showing the way a Mixmaster packet is constructed. We've got your headers telling where the message is to be sent, and you have successive layers of encryption, with the meat of the message being your final email message. A user in a free route system, a user picks the chain. The user's client, of course, selects the path that the message is going to travel, and then the client performs the successive encryption, does the padding, transmits the message, and an individual remailer operator can observe a number of things. Can observe messages coming into the network, can tell who is a user of the system who uses his node as the first hop, can tell who is a recipient of the system for messages that have chosen his remailer as the last hop. Of course, cannot link sender and recipient because there's no guarantee that a given message that's coming in is going to exit that same remailer. In fact, it shouldn't. But also, an individual operator has an intimate view of what traffic is like on the network and can possibly deduce speculation as to the behavior of certain users based on traffic load and fluctuations. Again, it's very important that we have a large enough anonymity set that these problems disappear. We won't ever get to a point where they're not relevant, but as you increase the anonymity set, you increase the sophistication necessary to process the data, and you begin pushing your adversaries out to a very small number of probably not a concern to anyone adversaries. There's also the use of cover traffic, which are dummy messages that are created either by the users or by the nodes to increase the anonymity set, at least internally. There's currently a lot of work being done on measuring exactly what dummy traffic adds to a system. And it really doesn't let you get a bigger anonymity set. You can't replace users with dummies. But what you can do is using dummy traffic thwart a number of different attacks. And afterward, if people are interested, I can refer you to papers on this. There's still problems with Mixmaster. There's still potential for tagging attacks. You can manipulate the encrypted envelope in such a way that the message is still decrypted properly and sent along, but that there is a mark that you can trace. You can do flooding attacks. Mixmaster is pretty good at protecting itself against most flooding attacks, but the main motivation behind a flooding attack is to flush all the other users' messages out of a node, insert a whole bunch of your messages, plus a message that you don't know where it's going to, but you've got it somehow, and then watch when they come out. When all the messages come out, they're either all yours or the one that you don't know, which happens to be the one you're after. Mixmaster protects against that mostly, but there's still potential ways of doing flooding. There's potential for key compromise. Mixmaster recently, in the last year, added automatic key rotation, which helps with that in a way, but still has a problem of remailer servers need to be able to decrypt messages coming into them. That means there's a decryption key available on the server. That means that it's susceptible to subpoena or hacking. Reliability is a major issue with all of these systems. If your system is prone to failure and has reliability problems, you won't have users. They're not going to send email that may not arrive if they have it has a history of not working. The future remailers being developed right now, Mixmaster 4.0, Mixminion, are based on a protocol designed primarily by Roger Dingelbine, who's here, Nick Matheson, and George Denezes. The main intention here is to fix a number of the little flaws with Mixmaster and allow a way of doing return addresses. I'll answer questions about return addresses afterward if people are interested. It's in beta right now. It doesn't have a sufficient number of users to be reliable at this point, and it's not been fully audited. So it is something that I would encourage everyone to use in the near future. But at this point, Mixmaster is still your best bet for a high latency email system. The high latency systems, but when we're talking about practical solutions, you're here because you want to know, what can I do to protect my anonymity right now? This is not theoretically what can we do down the road, what can we do right now? Well, whenever possible, use a high latency system. If it is acceptable for you to use a system which delivers your email in maybe a half an hour after you send it, use Mixmaster. There are situations, of course, where you have to rely on something better than that as far as latency. There's always the concern of knowing your anonymity set size. I'll drill down that to the down into that deeper, but if, for instance, you are sending messages and you're encrypting them to your recipient and you're using a version of PGP on the final encryption, which is, say, GPG 1.0.7 beta 31 for Windows, that's leakage there. You're now diminishing your anonymity set by revealing that you use an obscure version of that crypto. Different versions of PGP also implement things differently. There may be variations in the way packets are constructed, ordered, the way ciphers are chosen. All this allows a sophisticated attacker who's going to analyze these messages to whittle down your anonymity set. So if your concern is anonymity, even though you're using a strong high latency system, you need to be concerned about all aspects of this. That is, of course, if you're concerned about somebody who's able to do these attacks. If your concern is simply not wanting your grandchildren to find out that you were posting to alt-sex bondage back when you were in your 20s, you might have a different concern altogether. It's a lot harder to break anonymity after the fact when you're analyzing postings than it is if you have the capability of monitoring the network. So what about low latency? I want web pages. I don't want to wait a half an hour for each one to load. Tor and JAP are the most widely used and, at the present, best solutions for this. There's two major differences between Tor and JAP. Tor is a free route system. It allows users or the user clients to select their own paths. JAP picks paths as part of a cascade. There's a fixed route that messages will always travel, and they're always created that way. You always go A, B, C, D. Whereas with a free route, it is random. There's arguments for and against each of these methods, but it basically boils down to, we know how bad cascades are. Free routes are a lot harder to analyze. My personal intuition is free routes are probably better, but that's currently being hotly debated. The other issue is decentralization versus centralized architecture. Recently, in the past year, the German government went up to the nice fellows at the University of Dresden and asked them to insert a backdoor in the JAP client and asked them to log requests to a certain web page and report who was doing this so that they could... It was either they wanted to know what an individual was doing or they wanted to know a recipient web page. I think it was people connecting to a certain web page. This was something that the operators of the JAP system and publishers of the software, because they were the same, could do. Because all messages, all traffic exited from their node. Because of the cascade, they knew that every message that was going to come out was going to come out of one of the systems they operated. All these exit nodes were in Germany, they had control over all of them, and they had control over the content of the client. To their credit, they did put in something like government badness protection code and a comment in the backdoor they added, but it went about 6 weeks before somebody discovered this. It is open source software. The many eyes theory here falls flat if you're one of the users whose privacy was violated during that 6 weeks. In a system like Tor, you can't have that kind of scenario. Every operator is a potential exit node, and while the Tor client could be backdoored, in order to get this information to a central point, you'd have to have some sort of side channel for passing that information, which is likely going to be detected, or you could have it log locally so that whoever wants this information will go to each exit node and obtain it somehow, but that's also likely to be detected pretty quickly. Note that in the case of the JAP compromise, it was a government agency doing this, which may or may not be a problem. My understanding of German law is that you can fight a subpoena, but you have to comply with it while you're fighting it, which sounds pretty broken to me. Because even if you win against, you know, and successfully fight the subpoena, you've already lost, effectively. But there's other ways of coercion. You could have, well, the Earth Liberation Front coming and breaking your kneecaps because people are discussing new ways of animal testing over your system and they want the keys. You want to build a system where there's no way to coerce out of you the secrets that it is intended to provide, to hide. Right now, both of these systems have small user numbers. There's some X number of hundreds of thousands of potential users of JAP. At the moment, less using Tor because Tor's JAP has a head start on Tor, and Tor has some potential scalability problems. It hasn't been tested after a certain size. As software developers will know, you can't say it scales to anything greater than order of magnitude of what you've tested it at. It's just not able, you're not able to predict that. So there's speed bumps in the road for the development of Tor. But once we get those user numbers up, this will be a better system that many of us can trust. Maybe right now, it is acceptable under your threat model. If your concern, again, is to hide your identity or identifying information from a particular website, you're not worried about somebody monitoring the traffic, you're not worried about your ISP. These are all perfectly acceptable. If the attacks that you're worried about are infeasible in the system, you can use it. Remember that number of users does not equate to anonymity set. If, and I'm pulling this number out of the air here, but if Tor says it has 100,000 users, that may be the number of users that use Tor or have downloaded it in the past month, but it's not the number of simultaneous users who use the system when you're using it, always. An observer who's clever can watch the network and determine that these 10,000 people are using Tor at this point in time. And then the next day, these 10,000 people are using Tor at this point in time, but there's a difference between those 10,000 and these 10,000. And you're noticing, let's say you're after a certain behavior, this web page is being fetched both times, so you know the user you want is in both groups of 10,000, but there's only 2,000 users that are in both groups. The set overlaps at 2,000. Now the enemy set size is 2,000. Do this again, and again, and again, and eventually you're able to whittle it down. So that this is referred to as the long-term intersection attack. I can point you at papers that discuss this further as well. But anonymity set size is a tricky issue. In order to have a sufficient anonymity set size, you need to have massive numbers of users. Back to the leakage issue. It does you no good to protect your link if you're doing things like leaving what you're talking about in the clear, leaving your requests in the clear, leaving something that's going to link back to you after you've done all of this complicated stuff to hide yourself. At the end of it all, you say, this is who I am. For email, using PGP or SMIME, or better yet, in the case of MixMinion, an internal encryption scheme, if your recipient has the proper client, which is geared toward normalizing the encrypted message so that there's not identifying information, you have to add this in order to achieve this protection. For web privacy, the one that the Tor developers recommend is Provoxy, and it works very nicely with Tor. There's two ways of doing this. One is having a local filter on your outgoing requests. The other is to use a proxy server. The way Anonymizer works and the way you can set up middleman and Privoxy is to have a separate proxy server that you route all your requests through that does the sanitation for you. Of course, that's a point of attack, and you need to remember that. Don't do things that are unique. That should be obvious, but it has to be stated again. Be aware of your threat model and know your risks. Know what parts of your threat model are covered and what aren't. There's the potential for people to believe that because they're using an anonymity system, they can do incredibly stupid things. This is not the case. You must know how much your anonymity system will protect you against the people you might be pissing off or might want to hide yourself from. Just because you have this protection doesn't mean you should push it to its limits. So, where does this leave us? The strong anonymity systems out there right now are pretty hard to use. For now, we're getting better. The privacy and security communities have been, in the past few years, becoming more and more aware of the inherent problem that usability itself is a security concern. We've seen things in the past few years like the new PGP Universal product, which aims to make the whole process of encrypting your email much more simple. You've seen a lot of the browsers incorporating better, finer-grained granularity on what information you're going to be leaking out, what information you can protect. This is now built into the browser where it should have been in the first place, so you don't have to install a separate app. But we need to keep going with this. This is not nearly as easy to use yet. Because remember, the end goal is you want to hide among the AOL users, the Earthlink users, the random person on the internet users. If you successfully use an anonymity system right now, and you are able to use it without messing up, you've identified yourself as likely somebody who's in this room, or somebody who is a computer scientist, or someone who is a hacker, or in some way sophisticated enough to get all this to work and know it exists. We need to eliminate that little bit of identifying factor there. This needs to be accessible, intuitive, available, and widely used by everyone, or at least by a large subset of Joe Normal. There is the latency, user, and anonymity trade-off. Against a global observer, someone who's watching the entire network in real time and analyzing it, as your user numbers go down, or as your latency goes down, your anonymity also drops. The problem with this, as I mentioned with the intersection attacks, where you take a window of number of users at a current point and you compare it to users at successive points in time, with a high latency system, a point is a bigger thing. Anyone using the network in a given two-hour period could be who you're looking at versus who's using the system within these period of 2 seconds in a low-latency system. So as you extend that window, you can have less users for the same amount of anonymity, provided you've got an appropriate ratio of people who are behaving the same way. There's still the problem that anonymity is confusing. I've been giving talks about anonymity at Black Hat for the last few years, and fundamentally the talks haven't changed all that much, because the basics of anonymity are still really complicated, and the moderate level depth of anonymity is still being discussed in academia. We don't have a good handle on a lot of these issues. We have a lot of intuitions, but anonymity is a field that's fairly new. So while we're grappling with these problems, we also have to remember that we need to step back and explain these things in a coherent manner to our users, and that's difficult. But if we want to see anonymity be widely used by Joe Normal, we need to see complete solutions. We need to see a packaged up version of software that handles everything that I've just talked about. We need to have Privoxy and Tor bundled together and pre-configured in the correct way. We need to have remailers that also provide content encryption, etc. We cannot simply step back and say, I'm an anonymity developer, I have an anonymity tool, it doesn't do content encryption, that's your problem, go get PGP. That raises the bar and makes it much more difficult to use. So what can you do right now as a user who wants anonymity? I recommend Tor if you're looking for websites. I recommend using Provoxy. I predict that somebody, hopefully the Tor developers, will bundle the two together soon and we'll have more users. But again, remember that there are in the tens of thousands of users at most right now on that. For email, Mixmaster, pretty soon Mixminion. But again, know your threat models. You can assess that, I can't. If it's dangerous for you to be using a remailer system at all, if you stick out and then you're known as somebody using anonymity and therefore hiding something, you may not want to use it. However, if your concern is communicating between, for instance, remote offices, if you work in a company that has distributed offices and you don't want the ISP or the telco or a foreign government that happens to be where one of your offices is watching your traffic and doing traffic analysis or determining that you might be interested in some website because lots of your members of your organization are going there, it is advantageous to use these systems. Against many attackers, we don't need to worry about the global observer partitioning attacks. I'm going to jump to questions here. So, that one in the back. Well, that's three questions. The first question was, is commercial anonymity dead? Commercial strong anonymity is dead. It died when zero knowledge died, or reinvented itself. However, there are a number of companies that are selling anonymity products with varying degrees of that snake oil smell. The second question was, are they irrelevant because governments can put pressure on you? Well, again, most people who want anonymity are not worried about governments, or they're worried about that certain government over there. And depending on where you are and who you are, the government may not be the issue. There are companies that have been around for many years who have successfully resisted subpoenas because of the way they kept their information, but they have other problems. There are a few large commercial anonymity providers who have in the tens to hundreds of thousands of users and are a trusted, centralized anonymity provider who either assures the reputation that they're not going to give you up or has the law on their side in that if they reveal your information, they violate privacy laws. But if their services are not up a good portion of the time or incorrectly programmed or crash when you try to use them or pose other problems, you're going to have users leaving and people disincentivized to use them. The big problem is there's not much capital in that, as I see it, not much capital available for investment in anonymity solutions because the potential return is questionable. So doing a professional job of providing anonymity solutions is difficult. Did I get your whole question there? Next question?
Spam, the Joe user you were talking about incorporating into this is probably very happy to give up his shot at anonymity to kill the spam on the network. And then, of course,
I don't. There are many more users on the internet than there were when the first implementation of Chom's ideas was written in 93. There are vastly more users on the internet than when Chom wrote his paper in 1981. That's more users who will potentially be part of the anonymity set. There is greater anonymity on the internet today than there was 20 years ago, just in general, because of this. It is a fallacy that many people simply assume to think that anonymity and spam are tied together. There are ways that you can build anonymity systems which make it difficult and non-advantageous to use it for spam. In fact, Mixmaster I've never seen successfully used for email spam. I can dig deeper into why that is, but I want to get some other questions first. If you still have spam questions, I'll answer them. And as far as the evil empire, I don't think there's a... I think any large company like that is unlikely to have a malicious agenda that is of any particular form. They'll give their users what they want. And users are now saying, we want privacy. And of course, they don't want to pay for it. They want it just to be there. But if it is advantageous to their users that anonymity systems be available, they will go that way. So people think of these entities as potentially against privacy or invasive, but the end goal is they want to sell copies of their operating system, or they want to sell their service. Maybe the OS level isn't the place to do it, but the ISP is. Again, there might be government pressures to allow monitoring, etc. You brought up terrorism. The simple reality is the bad guys already break the laws. That's why they're bad guys. What this kind of technology does is level the playing field. You've got criminal organizations that are using the internet in specialized ways to obtain, for their threat model, anonymity already. Stopping the distribution of strong anonymity tools doesn't take it away from them. What it does is it takes it away from the good guys. So there's a trade-off here. Do you take an action that can potentially increase your ability to investigate crime that also decreases an individual's ability to protect himself? When I talk to law enforcement and I pose it that way, they usually go, well, we'd rather the individual be able to protect themselves. It's better to help avoid victimization in the first place, even if it means making it a little bit harder to track it after the fact. That adds a whole nother layer of... Why can't you go into Best Buy and buy a prepaid phone card and use that as a currency, or mint your own chips online, or... The problem is, again, anonymity set size. The people that pay for services through Best Buy are small, because A, if you're going to go to Best Buy and buy a phone card for the purpose of using the internet, that's a usability barrier. We don't want to have to deal with those kinds of problems, and that's a separate issue. It's not, you're not going to get a lot of users by saying, okay, you got to do these 10 different things before we'll even sell the product to you. A couple years ago, American Express tried a prepaid credit card, which I was really glad that they did, but they canceled it very quickly. But you used to be able to go into 7-Eleven, give them $20, and get a Amex card that was good for $20, and it was a credit card, and it worked with the credit card system. And here was a way you could individually pay for things yourself and not have it be linkable. Some anonymity, commercial anonymity providers accept cash in the mail, but people that are willing to put their cash in the mail and mail it off and hope the postal service delivers it, of course, are small. So it's, the real solution is you want strong digital e-cash, and we're never going to have it. even though it's technologically feasible, it's never going to happen. So thankfully, the NGOs, the universities, the individuals have done a good enough job of providing strong anonymity systems out of their own pocket that this hasn't been a barrier to strong anonymity. It's just been a barrier to making lots of money off of it. Question? They released, so Zero Knowledge, when they, a little bit, well, about a, 9 months after the shutdown, they released their server source code at the CodeCon convention in San Francisco. But they released it under a license that said you can't profit off of it. And there was not that much interest in it. The Shmoo Group hosts the Zero Knowledge source code in a CDS repository on the net. And you can go look at it, and you can see the cool stuff they were doing. But at this point, there are no Freedom servers running. And at this point, it doesn't make sense to run one. Tor has advanced beyond what Zero Knowledge was. So if you're looking for what Zero Knowledge did, look at Tor. Even if Zero Knowledge were marginally better, it wouldn't be because there are less nodes and no users. So there's that trade-off there. But the main difference between Genin Router and Zero Knowledge was Genin Router is TCP-based and Zero Knowledge is UDP-based. So you have some potential protocol problems with Genin Router, but that I understand is being addressed. There is currently work by Fitzman, P-F-I-T, type it into Google, however you'd want to spell that, and they'll correct you, working on codifying definition of terms. First of all, anonymity. There are a number of papers that discuss threat models. The one that I'd point you to off the top of my head is called From a Triple to a Flood, which mainly details the different attacks. I think you can extrapolate from that the threat models. The primary author on that is, help me out, Roger. Andrei Serjantov, S-E-R-J-I-N-T-O-V. Roger is one of the co-authors, so you can go harass him afterward. Of course, I define anonymity as, you know, the state of being indistinguishable among other users. That is a very nebulous definition in and of itself, and when I say it depends on your threat model, I mean when you've achieved anonymity is something that you can only cannot be determined without the greater context of what your threat model is. Also, you may want to look at the Black Hat slides that from the talk that Roger and I did last year where we discussed attacks and defenses against anonymity systems. Yes, that's in those slides. But that's another 5 minutes, and I'm running out of time. So let me see if there's any other questions. There's somebody back here. Yes? Yes, in fact, I'd argue that you'd want multiple governments who are not necessarily cooperative running different nodes. I'd love to see, for instance, the Palestinians and the Israelis running Tor servers, because you're not going to have collusion, and you could pretty much guarantee you're not going to have collusion there. The Onion Router project is funded by the Navy. There's I don't know that the Navy is actually running any nodes, but yes, having governments run anonymity systems is a good thing because it's usually hard. It's easier to strong arm an individual than it is, say, a college, but it's usually pretty hard to bully around a government. And your point is well taken. Other questions? No? All right, then. Thank you.